Hello, and welcome to episode 52 of the Story Hack Podcast. The Story Hack Podcast features action, adventure, and mystery stories, mostly from the public domain. Story Hack is also a print magazine, which publishes new action and adventure stories in a wide variety of genres. Visit storyhack.com today for more information. Today will be part 3 in a series, reading The Prince of Mars Returns by Philip Francis Nolan.
Chapter 7. I Trail Dacko's Villains. A few moments later found me galloping with Banner at the head of a band of mounted duelios. Banner had supplied me with a great, powerful brute of a dog to ride. The beast looked understandingly at both of us when Banner turned him over to me. Wagging his immense tail, he accepted me from that moment as his master. Both the duelios and the dogs on which they were mounted accorded me the same understanding at a word from Banner. The young Martian then drilled me in the words and methods of command necessary for their control. The most remarkable affection existed between the duelios and their mounts. There seemed to be a perfect understanding of commands and coordination of action. The dogs were more intelligent than the great duelial apes, but of course lacked much of their physical prowess. Both, Banner explained, were terrible in battle, although quite docile to the commands of their master, whoever was the leader selected by the Northerners for a particular task. To me, it was also comforting to learn that the duelios were trained to the use of the spear and a short, broad-bladed sword almost like a cleaver, and that they carried these weapons with them. We're taking an overland shortcut toward a little seaport at the boundary of Bolan and Gakarlu, Banner said. It is there, undoubtedly, that Gacko has taken Lil Rin. For once out on the sea, she will be in Gakkolan waters, and he will have a run down the coast of only some 700 miles to Gacko's own city. Will we catch them there, do you think? Not we, he said frankly. Possibly you. But if you can't overtake them before they reach their own territory, I should advise you not to try it, but to journey on leisurely along the coast of the Polar Sea until you arrive at the city of Gakarlu. Establish yourself there as let me see, now as the son of a rich merchant of Ilmo, for that is the land farthest away from Gakarlu across the pole, and you would be less likely to meet Ilmonians in Gakarlu. For the rest of our journey, as our great dogs tore along with us at amazing speed, and the cavalcade of duelios raced after us, Banner supplied me with much information as to the customs of the Martians. At length he motioned me to give the order to halt for the duelios, and dogs now looked to me only as their master, as Banner himself had previously commanded them. He pointed toward a silvery sheen on the horizon beyond a growth of short ferns. "It is the sea," he said. "Your way lies straight ahead. You will see the village after a little bit. Luck be with you, and may you return safe from this daring adventure, for there are many things I would like to discuss with you, things which I feel I cannot talk over with you at this time. Besides, there has been so much information to give you. On what points are you curious?" I asked, having a pretty good idea of what was on his mind from the surreptitious glances he had been casting my way. "Well, for one thing, your colouring is like that of no man I have ever seen," he stammered, and his face grew red. "Indeed, throughout all history, even back through the legendary period of the great Reign of Fire, there is no mention of men with brown hair and deep blue eyes. You appeared suddenly from nowhere, it seemed, among the Tar Ennir. At least, so Mornia told me. Among the southern clans, it is considered bad manners to pry into the affairs of strangers and guests." He smiled deprecatingly. "You see, our own customs are somewhat different. Does history or legend shed any light on the lands below the equatorial desert?" I asked him. "None," he admitted. "It is a great subject for speculation among the wise men as to what may be on the southern half of the globe. We know, of course, that we do live on a globe and not, as it might seem, on a great, flat, circular world. But somehow I do not believe you cross that desert. Neither do the Tar Ennir." I laughed. "What do you think, then?" I asked. "My thought is so wild that I hesitate to take it seriously." He was looking at me keenly. "Have you ever watched the skies at night and gazed on the green planet?" By green planet, Banner meant, of course, Earth, for that is how Earth would look to the Martians. Often I had to admit I've often seen it from a distance. Well, considering the many space voyages I'd made, that was true enough. Have you ever wondered whether it was a habitable world? No, I never had to wonder about it. The look of disappointment on his face was eloquent. He had been shrewd, but he had been frank, too. I could but reply in kind. After a pause, I added, I know that it is. What? Banner shouted. Then you really? Yes. That is where I came from. Earth, we call it. Banner acted like one suddenly bereft of his senses. He shouted and laughed, waving his arms madly. Then as quickly he turned and was gone, his great dog racing and bounding across the plain away from me, back in the direction from which we had come. Amazed and puzzled, I could only gaze helplessly after him, and by the time I thought of calling out to him, he was beyond hearing. Then came the thought of little Lilrin. Well, that was my job, wasn't it? So, with considerable misgivings, I turned toward the distant polar sea. I shouted, "Hep!" and pointed forward. In an instant, followed by the Dulios and the dogs, I was bounding along, frequently grabbing at the saddle handle to steady myself, and muttering the while a silent prayer that at least I had had experience riding horses. To my earthly eyes, the village was indeed strange. I was astonished to find that most of the buildings were underground. In this they were quite unlike the only other Martian structures I had seen, the ancient, iridescent monoliths. The modern Martians, as I was to learn, dug their cities and villages deep underground with thick wall superstructures. Soil and rock were mixed with a red cement, made into large slabs or bricks. The superstructures were little more than entrances and anterooms to the quarters beneath. Remembering what Banner had told me that the gasto, or inn, would be located on the outskirts of the village, I held up my hand. The great dogs behind me slithered to a sudden stop, as did my mount. I looked around for a shaft of stone or cement bearing a picture or a carving of a dog's head. A metal rod projected from a hole in the ground beside it. This I lifted and let drop again. Somewhere down in the ground there was the sound of a gong, and the metal door in the wall before me was opened. Chapter 8. I Rescue Lilrin. There, standing before me, stretching his arms wide and bowing with some difficulty, the first fat man I had seen on Mars. On the far side of the building I found were cage-like structures for the dogs and the Dulios. After ordering my animals to remain in them until I called, I followed the innkeeper back around the building to the metal door. From here, a circular ramp led down to the lower levels. I stopped at the first level to pay my board and lodging with the heavy little red beads rubies. I think they were that the Martians use for money, since gold is far too plentiful. I drew a puzzled glance from mine Martian host when I laughed, because the little cage at which I paid was so much like a cashier's corner in innumerable little restaurants on a planet millions of miles away. My room proved to be on the third level down. I was shown from my room to the mocker, which I suppose would be translated in English variously as lobby, barroom, or restaurant. It was on the first level below ground. Here, gathered about the great solid, carved blocks of quartz that served as tables, were seated some score or more of Martians, all of the Ilden class, or freemen. This I gathered from the green sashes they wore like my own with which Banner had outfitted me. In a far corner of the room was a little party of four, obviously strangers to the village, for like myself they seemed to be interested in their surroundings. They surveyed their neighbors with some curiosity. Two of them were Epsom Lesser Lords. They wore the red sash, distinctive of their class. The other pair were Ilden, a couple of slaves, obviously members of the party and not in attendance, garbed in the black that denoted their position in life, hovered in the background with big bowls and jugs. There was a vacant table near the group, and I moved toward them as unconcernedly as I could. They seemed to take no notice of me. Almost immediately the name Gacko, although uttered in a hushed tone, caught my ear. I strained to hear more, but without much success for a while, for one of the inn servants was placing my food before me. Later I heard the city of Gokarlu mentioned a few times, and there was something said about the seaworthiness of a certain wheelboat and the necessity of guarding someone well under pain of Gacko's violent displeasure. I had no doubt it was Lilrin to whom they referred, and that this was the party I was after. Certainly there was something furtive about their manner, something sly that argued there was no good in the business that had brought them here. I felt for the little automatic under my shirt, and casually unfastened the garment a bit at the neck that I might reach it quickly. None of those in the room had taken particular notice of me as yet, and I was thankful for the rather dull light thrown by the crystal bowls placed in recesses along the walls in which wicks floated. I was thankful, too, for the Martian custom that did not require men to uncover indoors, although women were supposed to a curious reversal of the practice on Earth. I was trying to decide upon my next step when fate took the initiative. There was a sudden commotion near a triangular door that gave access to one of the lower-level ramps. A slender girl in the black garb of a slave dodged frantically among the tables toward the group I was watching. Her progress was marked by growls and resentful glances. One or two Ilden half rose in their places, then sank back again quickly enough when they saw the red sashes of the Epsom, who had risen in some alarm as the slave girl fought her way toward them. But once she had made her breathless report, the four men, followed by the girl and the two slaves, dashed for the ramp. In the excitement, I followed. A turn in the ramp muffled the commotion behind us, and I heard the patter of the conspirators' running feet as they circled downward. I leaped after them, closing the gap quickly, and stopped barely in time to avoid turning another corner and crashing full into them. They paused at the fourth level down and threw aside the leather curtain that concealed a triangular door. With a rush, they were through. In addition to the two Epsom, there were four or five Ilden in the room and several slaves of both sexes. They had spread out and were cautiously closing in on a far corner of the room where a slim girlish figure, almost denuded of clothing and bleeding from an ugly gash on the arm, stood at bay. In one hand she had a spring gun with which she kept threatening her enemies as one or another of them took a chance and tried to advance a step. In her other hand she held my large automatic. Here then was Lilrin of the Tarenner, the golden-haired, blue-eyed Amazon of the southern clan whom I had sworn to rescue. Lilrin, gloriously waging the battle of her life against a band of Martian vultures who leered evilly at her gleaming body, yet respected the deadliness of her weapons. Lilrin, my wife. Her clear, sweet voice rang out now with scorn as she taunted and defied them, and they held back like a pack of wolves. "Stop this folly! Throw down that weapon!" roared one of the Epsom, who seemed to be the leader, as he pushed his way forward to face the girl. "Be careful, Ualo," cautioned the other noble at his elbow. "She means it. She'll do what she says. I know these clansmen of the south, and the Tarenur are the most desperate warriors of them all." The other hesitated. "But this is ridiculous. She's only a girl, and the daughter of their leader." The Myarlur interpolated the cautious one. "It is best to take matters slowly." It was the psychological moment. I acted. Stepping inside the door, I raised my little automatic and fired a shot into the ceiling. The reverberation in that heavily walled room was terrific. It seemed to stun the Martians. Demoralization was in their faces as they swung about and saw me there like a statue, my gun half raised and a tiny wisp of smoke curling up from it. They shrank from me. "Come, Lilrin," I said. "We must get out of here. You go first and clear the way. Use my gun if you have to, but I think there are none above who have an interest in stopping us. I'll hold this scumbag." Lilrin looked at me like one who sees a happy vision and doubts its reality. I never saw her look more beautiful than at that moment, disheveled as she was and bleeding from the rather ugly gash in her arm. But there was no indecision in the girl. With her little shoulders thrown back, her chin high, and an expression of regal contempt for Ualo and all his followers, she stepped briskly to my side. For just an instant she paused and looked at me, an inscrutable something in her clear blue eyes. Then she slipped through the curtain door and was gone. Her disappearance seemed to break the spell. Stop them, at any cost. Uella roared, and threw himself recklessly at me. Instinctively, the rest leaped with him. 3 or 4 times my automatic roared, 4 of the enemy pitched headlong. But the distance between us had not been great, and even those who had stopped my bullets plunged into me as I went under from the combined rush, pulling the leather curtain on top of me as I fell outward through the door. As fast as I could press the muzzle of my gun against the new mark, I pulled the trigger, but my head was entangled in the curtain, and so many Martians had fallen on top of me that I could not at once wriggle free. It was then that I heard the heavier roar of Lilrin's gun. 5 times, at evenly spaced intervals, she fired, evidently aiming with calm deliberation. Then all was quiet, save for the groans of the Martians around me, and the curtain was lifted from my head. I struggled to my feet to meet Lilrin's anxious and inquiring gaze. "Are you hurt, Dinenle?" she exclaimed. "I was afraid they had gotten you. Now what shall we do?" In a few breathless sentences, I explained to her how Banner had helped me, told her of my Dulia cavalcade as we raced up the ramp. We found the mocker, the inn's public room, deserted. Nor did anyone appear to halt us before I blew a shrill call on the whistle Banner had given me. The great dogs and the yellow apes came racing to us around the corner of the building. I made 2 of the Duliels ride double, and Lilrin leaped on the back of the spare dog after I had bound her injured arm with a strip torn from her garment. And then we were racing away from the village, through the yellow-green ferns and back across the plain, toward Barter's Post. Chapter 9. I'd Become a Legend. "You've cancelled the debt of life forfeiture, Lilrin," I said to her. She gave an odd, quick look and laughed. "No, that didn't count. I told you, the slave is obligated to protect the master in battle. And besides, that is the 2nd time you have saved my life. I'm doubly forfeited now, Dainenle, whether you like it or not." I do like it, that is what I mean. I'm not accustomed to enslaving girls," I stammered. "Besides..." Lilrin sighed. "Then you must be awfully good at things you really are accustomed to," she said, and looked abruptly away over the yellow-green prairie as our strange cavalcade thudded madly on. For an instant my heart pounded. Did she mean? But no, that couldn't be. Certainly Lilrin did not want to be a slave. She, daughter of the chieftain of a warrior clan. Slave! Why, the girl was technically and officially my wife. There was no pursuit. Lilrin and I between us had accounted for nearly all of Uello's party. It was my impression that none had escaped, except perhaps a couple of the slaves. Presently the girl's eyes caught my own. "Before 3 suns have passed, the Tar-Ennir and our allies among the clans will be in arms against some or all of the polar cities," she said simply. Then suddenly Lilrin was all emotion. "Well, let it be," she cried fiercely, clenching her little fists. "It had to come. The legend must be fulfilled." "Legend? What legend do you mean, Lilrin?" But that was all that she would say. In due course we neared the agricultural post from which Banner and I had set forth such a short time before. Not 12 hours had elapsed. Captain Hanley's watch was of great convenience. He had found that the Martian day was almost the same as that on Earth. As we drew near, an Ilden, or Freeman, rode forth on a dog to meet us. But he paused suddenly some 200 or 300 yards away, gazed intently at us, then turned and raced madly for the post, waving his arms and shouting something. But he was too far ahead of us for me to hear what it was. I thought no further about the Ilden, but when we arrived, I was amazed to see no less than 150 spearmen in full armor drawn up in military formation, and at their head, in golden armor, a vermilion cloak over one shoulder, stood Banner of the Gap. In the rear stood rank after rank of Duliels minus armor, but armed with those terrible, short, broad-bladed swords. I halted in surprise. As if he had been waiting for the signal, Banner tossed his spear into the air. "Hail to the hero of the legend," he shouted. "To the Alar of the Green Star." In amazement, I turned to Lilrin, and to my still greater astonishment found her not surprised at all. "I knew it," she was saying softly. "From the beginning I feared it. and there was something of both tragedy and pride in the tear-dimmed eyes she turned to mine. "You heard him say it," she continued. "The legend of the Green Star. And you, Danin Leh, are the hero of the legend, and the legend shall be fulfilled. And then this little golden Amazon with the green-blue eyes did the last thing I had ever expected to see her do. She fainted and tumbled headlong from her saddle. In an instant I had leaped from my own mount and picked her up in tender arms. Poor kid, she must have gone through a lot while in the hands of Uello and his villains. Banner, too, came running to us and offered to carry her into the little fortress. But Lilrin on Earth would have weighed no more than 115 or 120 pounds. To my sturdier Earth muscles, she seemed no more than 35 or 40 pounds. I lifted her like a child and carried her into the building.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Story Hack Podcast. Make sure to check out Sidearm and Sorcery Volume 3. So when average people are swallowed up in supernatural trouble, sometimes they have to stand against the darkness by themselves. These are their stories. Included in this volume are 12 new stories of regular people facing the worst the paranormal world has to offer. These heroes may not have powers, but they refuse to be powerless. You can find more information about Sidearm and Sorcery Volume 3 at storyhack.com.